podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Back. Yes, it's me again. It's the Gags Tandon Show. And today on Twitter, I was just, you know, looking at my timeline. There's all these fake Gags Tandon pictures on there. And obviously, reaction to the Chris Williams podcast as well. And all of a sudden, I get a message from one of our older contributors. Right at the start, 2014-ish, I think he started. It's Mr. Mike Von Herf. And we just said, we DM'd each other and said, well, when do you want to come back on a pod? And he said, yeah, I'm free. So we decided to talk. So here we are. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Gags, how are you?
I'm good,
or should
man.
I say Hans? Should I say Hans?
Stop it.
My fellow German. We'll start doing our German podcast.
No, because I'll be lost.
Chris Williams and you holding forth in the Muttersprache.
Yes. Well, welcome back, mate. It's been a long time.
It has been a while.
The whole season, really. We've missed you. So it's good to get you back and talk. And, you know, you're a businessman. You're busy with business type of things. So I thought we'd talk something different. You know, we've been talking about about obviously qualifying for the Champions League, the summer, the transfer. So let's just break it up a little bit. I mean, it's a little bit related, but talk about the effect of, you know, the amount of money that's come into the game, in the English game especially, and what it has, you know, an effect it has on football, not only in this country, but the ramifications elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, it's ludicrous, isn't it, how much, I mean, let's just start with some of the numbers. Chelsea, last season, obviously we got the bump up, it's been bumped up. Chelsea for winning the league, and they were live 28 times, their total payment was £150.8 million. Liverpool got £146.1 million, so not far off but Liverpool were live 29 times, took a bigger share really. They were $5 million down on Chelsea in terms of prize money, but only $4 odd million down in terms of total. So it shows Liverpool actually earned more than them because they were live more. So
yeah, well, I think we were live for a record number of times, weren't we?
Yeah, 29. I think that was the most. Yeah, we were the highest in the league. We topped that one. We topped something at least.
So remarkable, huh?
So it just shows, you know, the about 2-3 years ago, I think it was around $30 million for the bottom of the league club, right? And Sunderland got $93.4 million to get relegated.
Jesus.
That was something. That was about, that was a figure that the champions used to get a few
that
years
is
back.
And probably the champions, probably what the champions got like 5 to 7 years ago. Like,
yeah, maybe even 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that was what the champions were getting. So you look at the difference then in what, say, the type of figures that Everton are spending, for example, right now, right? The amount of money the lower clubs in the Premier League can spend, Swansea and West Ham, they can all spend some money if they want to. They've all earned over, I mean, if you survive, you earned over 100 million, which is, so you've got 100 million at your club, and then obviously wages. So people are just either paying loads of wages, loads of money on wages, or just signing players. So you can't tell me that they can't afford to buy players, and this is also why the bloody fees have gone up.
Well, I think in the first instance, the thing that's good is just how the Premier League has blown up worldwide. Right, it has moved into another stratosphere entirely. I mean, I think the numbers that you're talking about here reflect very heavily the contract with Sky and so on. But I also believe that acceleration from 93.4 to the 150 that we now, or the, you know, mid-high 90s for the champion to 150 million probably reflects what they've been able to draw down in China. And, you know, they locked up an incredible deal last year in the United States with NBCSN. And the extent to which it's become an incredible property in the U.S., I think, can be seen in the fact that NBCSN has come forward with a new package wherein you can't just get all the matches on by signing up to NBC Sports Network. You've got to sign up for a second package that is an online offering. And there might be extra channels available over your television. But to get the whole package, you've got to do sort of multiple levels of premium, which, you know, it's always a terrible sign for fans when they've got to jump through that many hoops. But it shows that it's a seller's market, that they've identified their market and they've identified that people will pay for it. So, you know, on the plus side, the Premier League has done a great job packaging up the product and the way in which, or the game, the way in which the game is presented in the United States. I don't know if you've been here during the season, Gags, but it's incredibly professional. They've just taken it to a whole new stratosphere with the.
I have watched a few games on NBC and stuff.
And they've got all sorts of collateral content around it, whether it's documentaries, to give people a kind of a richer feeling for that they can, you know, that they can experience the game at a distance.
Part of me wants to do a deal with NBC as Anfield Index and say, yo, get me some access. Because if you look at it, they get so much access at the clubs as well.
It's incredible.
Because they're part of their deal and they have the press, they have the passes. They pretty much get so much access to go in behind, do interviews, sit down with Klopp. Like, it's not now that, oh, it's just Sky that have this media coverage. No, now the media coverage, if there's a big market involved, the Premier League sells a big package to this market, they then get access. That's part of the, like you said about these documentaries and these interviews, that's part of it. They come across, they come in and they say, right, we want this. And I think it was early on in EPL when this happened, I think I was running the EPL Index. There was a few people that were writers for NBC.
Yeah.
And they were based here, but they were getting loads of access to clubs because they were journalists. But because they were writing for NBC, the NBC offices or the people up top were just saying, yeah, you go to Spurs or you go there. And they were just like, from last season where I was just writing, doing nothing, you know, just like sitting at watching a TV game and writing or sitting at home. Now I'm in a press box. Like, it just immediately changed access. And like, I was like, oh, like, I wish I knew someone from NBC who could get us some bloody access. Do you get what I mean, though? But I mean, well, that was more selfish from my point of view, but money talks, right?
Right. No, there's no question about it. And they realize. Now, one of the key things that the Premier League needs to pay attention to is one of the big elements that they sell is the atmosphere at the matches, which has had kind of a weird contagion effect over here in North America, wherein matches even down to the, you know, here in Ottawa where I live, we have a USL team, which is the second tier below MLS, and Paul Dalglish is actually the manager, and in the USL. We're even seeing kind of English style and European style fan culture start to develop. And you certainly see that in spades at MLS, and that has, I think, as its origins very much, you know, an imitation of what they see at English grounds. So, one thing that the Premier League needs to keep, its eye on is how to make sure that they continue to, cultivate that on the ground by making tickets affordable, and we can go down our own rabbit hole there. But it, I guess what I'm trying to say is ticket prices as a revenue stream, on their own, has to be managed carefully because they could cut their noses off to spite their faces if the cop is full of corporates,
I don't think people, the cop's ever full of corporates, but I know what you're saying. What do you feel on that? That's a great little segue actually there. What do you think of that? So you see that Liverpool just earned 146 million, for example. Yeah. What are your thoughts on ticket prices then? I mean, I think they're still the same as last year. I don't know if they've gone up much this year, but what do you think in terms of them being as high as they are? Because obviously there was a bit of uproar last season before the walkout where they announced that there was going to be this significant, or the year before as well, when they announced there was going to be a significant increase with the main stand coming through. And obviously people weren't very happy with that. Really pissed
so
off.
So I have.
Can they justify Liverpool in terms of the prices? Should they? Should not just Liverpool? In fact, should the Premier League and maybe fan authorities get together and say, you know what? You're earning a lot here. How much difference does it make to just, you know, subsidize a little bit?
I'm pretty unsympathetic on one level to a lot of. It's such a complicated issue from my standpoint, but let's start where I finished, which is if you're looking at it purely from maintaining the integrity of the product, and I'll use that word and make a lot of people unhappy who are listening to this, but the integrity of the image of the Premier League, of English football, what comes across over the television, if you regard that as central to what you're offering viewers, which I think you are, you should be, then you need to look after that and figure out how to make sure that you've got that kind of atmosphere, and whether it's, you know, that touches on things like safe standing, that touches on issues like lower prices for people under 25, you know, like you have in places like you know, the 20 is plenty in Germany, but there, when you dig down a few layers, I have all sorts of issues that have to do with access to tickets for all sorts of people, including, you know, people who don't live in cities like Liverpool or cities like Manchester, or the secondary ticket market, and how people inherit their grandparents' tickets and those sorts of things. It's a very complicated series of dynamics that, you know, can quickly turn into locals versus you know, day trippers, or worse.
Yeah, that happens. There's a little bit of you know, angst, because obviously some of the locals then can't afford these tickets, but because of Liverpool's size and stature and fan base, there's always someone going to be available to go and buy that ticket.
Sure.
And I can understand the angst, you know, I can, because I, you know, if I was in that position, I'd probably be angry too. But I think it's just accepting that this club is just, it's humongous. Someone's always going to want to be there, and they will buy, if they've got the money, they are going to buy it. And that's why I always say I would like to see some kind of scheme, or because you a lot of people say, why does there have to be locals? I think there should always be locals at the game. There should always be, because I know passion comes from every supporter and any supporter, but I think it's important to retain, you know, the values.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of the city. Do you get what I mean?
Oh yeah. I totally understand that. It's such a tricky question. Because I guess what I've come around to the view, I used to think it was much more of a pretty simple supply and demand thing. And if there's demand, you know, in North America, buying tickets over face value is a standard fact of life. And when you look at what you pay to go to sporting events here, it's in another stratosphere from what, you pay at an English ground. So
it's a lot more expensive in America, you're saying?
Oh, tons more expensive. Oh, and the NFL.
So give us an example.
An Ottawa Senators hockey. So we have a NHL hockey team here. The best seats in the house there are, I think, with my firm. So they play 41 home games a year. And the best seats in the house are $195, or used to be around $200 a ticket.
Okay, that's expensive.
So that's. Yeah.
And the
that's
cheapest
a lot of. And this is a small city that's a government town.
Of course.
The cheapest, you know, the cheapest you can get for about $30 a throw.
Okay, so that's cheap though, right? And that's probably going to be in the rafters.
Yeah. But the, you know, it's an 18,000 or 19,000 seat rink, and
that's not too big.
So it's not like a football ground, right? But that's for a sport that has 41 matches a year, right? So if you've got season tickets, just think what that bill is. If you're a business that's got, and we're a government town in Toronto, those tickets, where Toronto Maple Leafs are probably the richest club. And those tickets run $500-$600, a seat in the lower areas. And that's for 41 home games a year. So just think what that, I'm not so good at math, but it's pretty, you come up to a pretty big number, by the end of the year, for the tickets that you have to buy. So that's our yardstick.
Because obviously sometimes when you're on, let's say, social media and you have this ticket stuff going on and there's arguments, and then you always see those based in North America always saying, what are you moaning about? Are you moaning about? Because it's because you're used to it. It's because the culture in America is that these tickets are always pricey to go to, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I think here, this has been the case for a while now, but I suppose the way it's gone in the past and grown and the prices have gone up and up and up, I think it's still something that people moan about. You know, something still people would say, in this day, I used to pay this much to go to the game. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
And they compare
exactly right.
It, but it's become a massive business.
So, yeah, So I used to see it as purely a supply demand thing. But on the other hand, I think it's actually integral to how the Premier League is being packaged. And so they play with that at their great risk. Where I get emotional about this is where I think people feel like they have an entitlement to receive something cheap because, they get a cut rate deal because they happen to live close to the ground. When in fact, that's just another kind of advantage, right? Like you can say, well, so-and-so traveling in from out of the country is bringing, and they've got more money than I do. Okay. But that's unfair, but isn't it equally unfair if you live close to the ground? Isn't that another kind of an advantage? You know, so,
It's interesting because, like you just said, the day tripper that's coming in, for example, is going to stop to eat somewhere around the ground, or before they get to the ground in Liverpool, is going to maybe have a few drinks at the pub in Liverpool. You know, either way, if they're coming in by train, they're going to be at the train station, they're going to spend some money there, you know, for the trip back. At the end of the day, what they're doing is they're still bringing money into the economy, into the city, aren't they?
Absolutely.
And that's vital as well. Keeps people at jobs, it's paying,
And I would have more sympathy for people who are season ticket holders, who are local and, who say, look, I'm integral to what Liverpool stands for. If I could be sure that those people weren't touting those tickets. And that whole issue of the secondary market. And as people have pointed out to me, they said, look, that some of that secondary market also comes from corners that have close relationships to the club. They're not necessarily season ticket holders and travel groups and those sorts of things who take advantage of a position with access to tickets to tout tickets. But there are a fair number of season ticket holders who tout their tickets. We know that to be the case. Because we know people who've had access to matches that way. And that to me is it's a double standard. It's kind of like, it's okay if you're from Liverpool to do that, but it's okay if you're from Liverpool to do that because, you're local or whatever. I don't entirely understand the logic behind it, but I do think, it's a very complex issue that has to be, I think, managed in the first instance from the standpoint of how are we going to look after what we associate with Anfield and when people go to Anfield and make sure that's right. And then after that, I think you have to look at, other kinds of fairness things, because I think foreign fans do have issues around access to access to tickets. So hopefully Tony Barrett will take care of all of that in his new role.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. And, it's an interesting one. I mean, look at the transfer fees right now.
Yeah.
there's reports, obviously, Liverpool offered €65 million for Naby Keita, and that was rejected. Obviously, they're going to have to go in. I think they're saying the fee's got to be around €75 million. So, I mean, a few years ago, that's unheard of, Mike, for Liverpool to spend that. You know,
When you gave me the 146.1, I think that's a Van Dijk and a Keita, and that's you're done. Your 146 million is gone.
Wow, this is so true. Yeah, exactly right. That is your money totally spent on two players. But it's got to be, well, it's, I mean, from a fan's point of view, we've been crying out for it for a long time. Can we go and spend some money, please? Can we? And there's a possibility that we break our own transfer record maybe three times, because I know they're saying Salah was 35, but I reckon there's add-ons in there. So the total fee will end up being more than Carroll. So you could actually see Liverpool, you know, breaking their transfer record three times in a summer. That should tell you everything of what money's doing to the game.
No question. And of course, I think another factor in this is the money that China is introducing into transfer fees. It's just this kind of weird, sort of like the old days when I was first starting to watch the game in North America, where the NASL, the old NASL in the 70s, was luring people like Beckenbauer and Ruud Krol and Pelé, Carlos Alberto, luring them over to North America. Suddenly there was an infusion of money into the game that distorted the market a little bit. And I think the risk of a Chinese swoop seems to be part of everyone's maths these days.
Really? You think it's that? I don't think the Premier League clubs are too worried about, in terms of, you know, like players here, based here, that really know they want to go here and there. I understand, like, obviously there's been a few players that have gone to China, like Oscar and most of them Brazilian, right?
I think a lot of them, eh?
A lot of them were Brazilian, right? So, I mean, and I think a lot of them in Europe, I don't think have, or from, that are from Europe. I don't know many. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I...
No, I guess what I'm trying to say is that those players would normally be pulled in, even by mid-tier clubs in the Premier League, and it would give you more options. Suddenly, a lot of those options are sort of like Russia did for a period of time, where suddenly, you know, good players who might go from what I'll call feeder leagues, like in Portugal and other places, where that would be naturally be a hunting ground for the Premier League, or being suddenly disappearing into the into Russia, or in some cases the Ukraine.
Russia is definitely one. They were, you know, they've been, there was definitely players going into those leagues, weren't there? And everybody's like, why are you going there? Again, it's shocking. What's going on? So I get what you mean. But also, I think there's other clubs, say, for in Europe, are always thinking, shit, there's a Premier League club coming in for this player. No way we can compete for the wages as well. You know, the level of wages are like Barcelona and Real Madrid. I mean, not Messi or Ronaldo levels, because those are unbelievable levels. But other players,
look at Keita, right?
I don't know what Keita will be on. There's no rumor of what he'll be on here, but it won't be anything less than 80 grand, surely, a week, which will probably quadruple his
what
wage.
I mean is that, from what I understand, Red Bull or RB Leipzig, I can't stop calling them Red Bull.
That's fine.
Red Bull, they have a pretty tight policy around maximum wages, understood.
I think I've read that somewhere too. They've got a cap, so basically...
That's right, and that screws them.
That screws everybody. But I mean, it just means as soon as a Premier League club comes in, you're done. But there was another little effect that I seem to remember in a couple of transfer windows, where people wait for money to change hands. So if a Premier League club here buys a player from this club in Europe, say, it kind of triggers off like a domino effect of transfers. because that club's waiting for money to come in. As soon as that they've paid that club then pays another, that pays that money to another. It's as if that money has just gone around four clubs. It's mental.
That's funny.
Yeah, honestly, it just, they've been, I can't put my finger on which ones. And if you're a listener and you remember this, or you can, or you do have these at the top of your head, I'm sorry, we're doing this on the fly as usual, you know, with my shows. There was a case where there was like a domino effect of transfers last season or the year before, where it was just like ping, 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 ping. And once that money goes into Europe, crosses into a club, that's it. It's just sale. It's just buy, 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 buy. All that money gets passed around. And it's like the Premier League club are just funded like three different teams.
It's from what I understand, the Salah money immediately started to move around from Roma, right? Into two or three other buys.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Exactly what that's an example of. Roma really needed to sell players this summer for their accounts and stuff.
FFP, yeah.
Bloody FFP. I can't believe that's still around. But so they basically that doesn't apply. FFP doesn't apply to English clubs anymore because the earnings are so high. They just totally just said, nah, we don't need it no more. We're earning over 100 million each. So fuck you. You know, what are you going to do about it? In Europe, that's not the case. So they've, like you said, that money's just been distributed. And that's a great example, actually, Mike. So that's the effect it'll have. And it puts the league in a very powerful position, but it puts them in a powerful position, but it hasn't helped the clubs though, has it? In terms of, for example, let's just say Champions League and how far the teams have gone. It hasn't really affected the quality and said, oh, right, these teams are now going into the finals. It's been a long time since a team from the Premier League has been in the semifinals and final.
Yeah. And I think we can put that down to the other effect of money, which is parity. Particularly skill, because clubs now can compete for a very, very narrow band of skilled players. Yes, you know, the elite type players are going to be the precinct of six clubs in the UK, in England. But that next tier down, of players who are maybe a little bit younger and have a lot of runway left, you know, that Southampton routinely recruit, or other clubs have access to, you know, a West Ham with a Payet and, who wasn't young, but was at a stage in his career where it was a bit of a gamble, but could have, a good year or two. It makes the possibility for a team to beat you on it, any team to beat any other team on, as they used to say in the NFL, any given Sunday, but any given match, any team can beat pretty much any other team.
I get that in the Premier League. I get that in the Premier League in terms of the parity, because obviously everyone now has money. So the signings that they can make and the wages that they can offer, for example, players like Shaqiri and stuff going to Stoke, you know, that type of example, going from Inter Milan to Stoke was a big surprise for everyone. Like, what the fuck is going on? Why is he going there? But so I get what you're saying, that there's parity. I mean, they still didn't do that well, Stoke, but that could be because of the manager. But anyway, that's all hearsay. I'm just saying that I understand the argument in the Premier League, but what about in the Champions League? So I understand
But there are no weekends off, is what it is. So
right. So you're saying more fatigue. But isn't that every league?
Well, no. I mean, no. The intensity, even Klopp talks about this, the intensity of an English match. I actually think, now Simon is the guy who knows this stuff inside out, and he talks about how mental fatigue flows from physical fatigue. But the intensity of these matches and the requirement for focus every single match, I think the Premier League is different in that regard. Because there just aren't weak. The top two thirds, okay, let's just say the top two thirds or even top three quarters of the league, you've got teams that perform at a very, very high level.
Well, Liverpool, for example, will be this year. It's going to be a very interesting year for us because we're going to have so much more. We do need a bigger squad. We do need these players because we are the team that runs the most. We are the team that sprints the most in the league. That's going to have some wear and tear. We're going to need extra players to come in, rotate, and then see. Let's see where we are at the end of that. So, yeah, okay. I can see that from your point of view. I still think we should be better.
Interesting to see how the TV money charts against the decline of performance in the Champions League.
That's an interesting thought. Very interesting thought.
Because if you think about it, when was that final with Chelsea and United where both were in the final? Was that
08?
Oh, 08, yeah. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to use that as your high watermark and backwards, because I think you'd see the infusion of cash into the Premier League has been if not exponential, pretty close to exponential since that time.
Since then, yeah. And before that, if you think about it, there was people in the final regularly. Wasn't there when were Arsenal in the final? 2003 or something? And then Liverpool were 2004-05? And then Liverpool again, 2006-07. And then United were in twice, I think, in that time. Three times maybe, because they lost to Barca twice, beat Chelsea once. So a Liverpool, Chelsea, Man United in semi-finals, regularly quarter-finals. So that was like the peak of English football in that era. But at that time, look at the managers that were around. But surely the managers at the moment in the league are no less than those. I mean, Mourinho's still around. And then you've got now Pep and you've got Klopp.
Yeah. You know?
So this will be Conte's first year with Chelsea. So it'll be really interesting to see. Sorry, first year in the Champions League with Chelsea. So it'll be very interesting to see how far he gets, because his Juve side did pretty well. You know, they used to get out of the group stages and go far into the tournament. But so we'll be interesting to see. Will be interesting to see, I think.
So, like, to me, one of the interesting new horizons on this, though, is I don't think we probably haven't tapped out TV money, but I think what one of the interesting facets of this whole piece is these new platforms that are emerging. You know, some of the leagues over here are starting to do deals with Facebook and Amazon and even Twitter, I think, where they're broadcasting games on those platforms in parallel with their traditional broadcasting contracts. And that's going to be a new revenue stream. But one of the things that I think is interesting is what our new chief executive brings to the mix in Peter Moore in terms of his understanding of from his work with EA of just how important that platform is and can be for marketing a club and for building, I hate the word brand, but for building a club's visibility, building its following, intensifying the relationships between new supporters and or would-be supporters and the club. I think there's tons and tons and tons of data that the ad company EA has access to that is very, very revealing, and I think we've probably got no better guy to understand it than the person who's at the top of our club's organization.
I mean, do you know how long he was there at EA? Because was he there for a lot of the rise of it, or was he only there for a few years?
Yeah.
He was there for the whole time, wasn't he?
Now, I would be BSing you if I knew his biography in great depth, but he's been there a number of years, and certainly in the building of the FIFA franchise, which has been just a phenomenal success for them. And here in North America, it's been really interesting to
2007 to 2015.
So, that was the sweet spot, right? That's where
10 years where they turned it around.
That's where it blew up, right? And he was part of Sega, and you know, he's a Silicon Valley guy, and that's why he's very comfortable on Twitter and in social media generally, and seems to just have a different MO than a lot of other traditional football executives. But you know, in here in North America, and I think this is, well, in North America, it's been absolutely crucial to building the following for the sport. Now, the Premier League is now, after the NFL, the sport that's followed most closely. It's either second, it might be third, but I think it's second most closely by that 18 to 35-year-old demographic male of males. And they say a big part of educating fans here, because the game was seen when I was growing up as far too slow and ponderous for the average North American sports fan. But FIFA has been absolutely crucial in educating those fans on the flow of the game, and on the tactics, and on the strategies, and importantly on the players, and you know, the manager mode and all those sorts of things, has really, really helped build. And NBC talks, the guys on NBC have talked about this, that the interaction between fans in North America with their club is like 10 times higher over the EA Sports than it is in actually watching and consuming, you know, watching matches and consuming the game. So they're spending 6, 7, 8 hours a week playing FIFA, and that gets them closer to their club, the club that they've chosen to follow. So I think that's a really interesting.
It's a money spinner with all the packages you can buy on the game. You know, it all, the evolution of FIFA was massive, wasn't it?
Oh,
it was just. I mean, that's probably not all down to him, though, is it? I mean, that's
no. But what I think we've got in having Peter Moore on board is someone who understands that as a tool to building affinity between the club and fans. And
yes, that's a key.
I've got a theory that's maybe also part of the reason why we are shopping in an entirely different stratosphere this go around. We don't seem. I mean, Klopp throughout his career hasn't been the guy who's shopped in the luxury aisle. He's been someone who's been very value driven. And Liverpool, since FSG took over, with the occasional splash here and there, has been very, you know, quote unquote money ball.
There are rumors, though, Mike, that he's not involved at all in the
no.
In the procurement, you know, players at all?
No, I don't expect he is. I wasn't trying to imply that.
All right.
What I think, though, as an organization, is you'd ask yourself, okay, we've got people who actually know what they're doing. Here's what they say is valuable, and then you bring someone else who's, here's what I know in terms of marketing and building the brand of this club, and what the data shows me from my expertise. You build with this kind of player and who's got this kind of attractiveness to the following, and you can help to build your club. And of course, on-field performance is everything. The other thing about the players we're chasing is they're pricey, right? But they're relatively they're propositions who, based on their current trajectory, if you had to sell them in 2 or 3 years, you wouldn't lose a lot of money.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's so early in Peter Moore's reign, really, at the club. I think we could probably get together, back together in a couple of years' time. I think you need to give him a really good time with his feet under the table, don't you, to see exactly what difference can be made at Liverpool Football Club. But like you're saying, he comes with quite the
resume.
Yeah, the resume. I was going to say the CV. He comes with a big, big resume, like you said. So I think that'll be very interesting to see how it goes along. And
look at how we're behaving right now. We are shopping in the luxury aisle for the first time in a long, long, long time. And we seem to be approaching our targets with unprecedented focus and resolve. What do you attribute the difference to?
Oh my God, this is a great question. There's got to be an element of Klopp in it. There's got to be, because we have been a right mess in the way we've been going about transfers, you know. Some of it you can even point to this summer, at the start of the summer, with the trouble we got into. But like you said, there's something different this year. It's the first year, I think, that Klopp and is it Edwards? Michael Edwards are working together.
Yeah.
Because he's only just
Laptop boy.
Yeah, the laptop man.
Air conditioning and laptop boy.
Yeah, gets so much hate. But I think since he's become sporting director, that's his or managing director. I think sporting director, maybe one of the names. I can't remember what his exact title is, but since he's only become that in the last year or so, I think. Don't remember the date, but I think this might be the first summer window that both of these are working together. So. They seem to work together well. They seem, you know, Klopp speaks well of him. They seem to have something that's cohesive, at least. People make mistakes. We make mistakes all the time. You know, when you're at work, you make mistakes. They made a couple of mistakes early this summer. But in the whole, you don't get the rumours that, like you were getting under Rodgers, of this committee signing and this and that. I think there's a clear... Klopp says it's his final say. I think he's made that clear. I think he's made that clear with the owners as well. I have the final say, who we buy, yes or no. So if he thinks it's too much money, he's actually switched on as well, Klopp. I think it was Teixeira in January, he said, no, we're not paying that. And Draxler as well, no, we're not paying those wages. I think he was the one who was saying, you know, no. So I think there's a little bit more control. I think it's good to have control with a person. If there's too many, you know, too many cooks, it's that saying. I think in the past we've had... a total mess. Inmates running the asylum. There's just been absolutely craziness going on. And I think maybe this summer it's more compact and more together. Like I said, they still make some mistakes, but you know, people are human. But maybe let's see what happens by September the 1st, you know, August 31st. But if they are able to land all these players that we're linked with, you've got to say something's changed, right?
I'm seeing more organizational discipline,
right?
And I think it may be because of some of the change in personalities, clarity around roles. You know, Michael Edwards is his first summer transfer window in that role. Klopp's, you know, got 6 years left on his contract. There's clarity,
stability,
about that.
Right? Yeah. And also respect, man. Klopp brings respect as well. I know it's a bad thing to say, but I don't think Rodgers had that from anybody in terms of the higher ups as well. He was an inexperienced manager. He did really well for that year and a half, but he was inexperienced. Whereas with Klopp, I think there's an aura around him as well, and that demands respect in itself, I think.
Yeah, so, no question. No question. And, you know, he brings all this charisma and all this image. And, you know, in a sense, he also, because he's such a commanding figure, and such a strong personality, he takes a lot of pressure off the players in terms of, how the club markets its public image. Because he is very much, he's kind of the pole in the middle of the tent, right? That holds everything up. As opposed to in the past, it was Stevie. And before that, it was Kenny. And
it's a great point, actually, because obviously in the last time, Kenny was the last manager that, you know, people could look up to and stuff. But I think also, he was getting towards the end of his, you know, managerial career, let's say. And I think that was more to bring unity in the fan base at the club. And I think with him, I think he was very lenient. Some of the stories are true that you hear, he was very lenient on the players. They were kind of getting away with a lot of stuff while he was there.
Oh, yeah.
And you follow that up with Rodgers, who you go from that experience, legendary status, to absolutely brand new legacy, nothing. Swansea, you know, I'm not being disrespectful. What I'm saying is there's a big difference. And now you've kind of gone back up a little bit of a winner, somebody who's won stuff with a club that was absolutely in dire straits when he took over.
No question. And sorry, when I was talking about Kenny, I was talking Kenny Mark One.
Kenny Mark One was, there's no one touches that. That is, you know, modern, when I was growing up, that's it. I probably got to see some of the end of Paisley and obviously Fagan's year as well, but Kenny was what I grew up on. There is nothing better than that. That was, for me, that's what I lived. So the players, Barnes, Beardsley, everybody, that is exactly what, you know, I dream of having a run like that team did. I dream. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't even the best. The best was before that. Paisley's was the best run, you know? So that was, I missed out on that brilliant era, but Kenny's was still magnificent and for me, the best in my lifetime. So yeah, I mean, like, you're right. That's that we won't, I mean, and also the thing with Kenny was he was a player and then he became player manager. So he already had the respect when he became manager, even though he was inexperienced in management. He also had Paisley on the bench at the time as well. So there was loads of, you know, there was loads of things to help him along into that transition into management, you know. And also, he, think about it, he worked under Bob Paisley, you know, he played under him. You're not going to learn from, that's the best. You're learning from the absolute best. So
yeah, no question.
And
no
like
question.
Now, this is what maybe they're doing with Klopp and Stevie. Maybe this is what they're doing. I mean, I hope within the 6-year period that Klopp's here, we can say he's the absolute best and he's won us this league. And I pray, you know, I really do. And I'm not religious, but I pray to the football gods that this happens. And then you have Stevie under the tutelage of someone who's really successful at Liverpool Football Club, exactly what you want. And I think it's been in the papers recently, Klopp saying as well that he's going to be talking to Stevie a lot while he's, you know, in the academy. So there may be something there with that, Mike, because
wouldn't that be a great thing?
Yeah. If Stevie can become a great manager, it would be magnificent for the club. I mean, personally, I have my doubts, but, you know, he's at the start of his career and give him a chance like we do everybody.
Yeah, well, what I want to see is what the next 3 years are with Klopp. And I think one of the beautiful things with having him as the manager is in a strange way, he has been, in terms of the person who carries, you know, is the big pole that holds up the tent. He really did. That was the role that Stevie played for about 10 years. And to have a strong personality now at the heart of the club takes a lot of pressure off the players to have to be that big personality, and it allows them to just get on with being great at their jobs, which is hopefully winning the league and other silverware as we go forward. But you know, it's an interesting time to be a Liverpool supporter for sure, and it is it's an exciting moment because we seem to be at a point where the club is willing to splash out cash in a way that that is, like I said to you earlier, that is more focused and more resolute than I've seen at any time. And maybe, you know, maybe it's as simple as Klopp says, I know who can improve the squad. It's a special player who can improve this squad. And I'm not going to bring in some schlub just to make up the numbers. If they can't, you know, if they can't improve on what we already have, because, you know, look at the depth and quality of midfielders that we have currently. So you need a very special player that's going to improve on what we have.
I don't know whether this podcast is going to come out before the scouting special that I've done with a few guys on Naby Keita. I'm not sure which way we're going to line it up. It'll probably be dependent on what happens, but on that podcast, whether you've heard it or it's about to come, little bit of a spoiler that these boys have just said that they would spend any amount of money on this player. This player is three players in a midfield in terms of Naby Keita. So,
wow.
I mean, yeah, listen to it because I tried to get weaknesses out of these boys for this player and they were stumped. They would refuse. They refused to talk that he had many weaknesses. So the money they're spending, and, you know, I actually had a text message, a chat with John Ritchie, and just talking the figures that might be spent on this player. And he was like, you know, normally John Ritchie is just like, what the fuck are they spending that much money for? And he was like, have you seen this guy? I was like, a little bit. He goes, he's immense. Spend anything on him. Just get him. Like, you know, when people sound like that, I just like, yeah, fuck it. Just spend the money. He's amazing. Yeah. It makes you think, shit, everyone's like gone insane. But The proof will be in the pudding this season if we do sign him.
When I heard the figure for Kyle Walker is $50 million,
yeah,
it makes me a lot more comfortable splashing out the kinds of figures we're talking about for Van Dyke and for Keita, just because it's not like someone said the other day, $30 million seems to be the new $10 million in transfer fees.
Yeah, it is. That's the inflation rate. It's definitely so. If you buy someone for $8 million, it's flipping peanuts, which is the money that is apparently for Robertson that Liverpool are going to link to buy. So it's peanuts. Stop moaning about it. You know,
yeah.
In olden days, that's like $1 million. Really, you're going to moan quality wise, but Liverpool seems like they have a priority on where they want to splash the cash. Fair enough. Maybe the spine, we've been asking for a stronger spine for how many years now, Mike, on Pods? We have the conversation every year. And when you're on the NKS, there's always a question about the bloody spine.
That's right.
And maybe we are just trying to enforce that spine.
Well, that was my frustration at the end of last year. And I remember we had a podcast to start the year with John Buskell and Jim Boardman. And two things. One, we talked about the fact that I don't understand why we haven't improved on the area that we knew was deficient, which was the spine. why? And indeed, even basically the back four. And the other thing I remember about that podcast is that Jim Boardman said that the first three matches we could do really well, but it wouldn't be a surprise to him if Burnley's the one we lost. Mystic Jim. That's what we'll call
him. Oh, shit.
But in any event, I agree with you. I mean, we're addressing those weaknesses. And, you know, we'll improve them long enough because it sounds like we're serious about it. And we might have a good opportunity to get both of these outstanding players. But and they'll come in and they'll improve us. And then we'll start complaining about the goalkeepers again. Because that's what we do.
Of course. Money, money, money. I think that's what it's all about right now. Spending that money. And there's been a lot of, obviously, criticism of the ownership as well. Do you think that with them purchasing these players, if they do go on to successfully buy these players, they'll earn themselves a little bit of respite?
I don't think it matters. They don't really care. No, they don't really care what we like. They want to be. These people do this because they want to be successful. So all they want to do. I mean, God damn it, John Henry bought a newspaper. He bought a newspaper 2 years ago. You think that's what someone does because they A, care about what other people think, or B, they only want to make money. They want to prove that they're smarter than other people. And so that means winning. So, you know, he's reinventing the Boston Globe. And, you know, I think actually been relatively successful so far, you know, baby steps. And I think they just want to be – they've been very successful at the Red Sox, and I think they just want to be successful at this. I don't think they really care all that much about being loved by us. They just want to be successful, just like us.
Yes, just like us, just like Anfield Index. And I think that is the best place to end this podcast. Thank you so much, Mike, for coming back on.
Oh,
I can't believe we ended up talking so long. I thought this was going to be a 20-minute podcast. I honestly did.
Yeah, well, you know, Nina, what Nina always says, oh, I'm going to get the Von Herf answer here. There's no short answer
No short answer. Yeah, she loves you, man. So we're hoping you're going to be back on NKS then this year.
Can't wait. Can't wait.
Fantastic. Cannot wait
and,
for that.
And thanks for indulging me. Can't wait for the season to start. What are we talking? Is it
a month's time? Just a month.
28 days.
Yeah.
4 weeks.
This weekend, 4 weeks. Yeah, it's going to be mental. And, you know, everything. Anfield Index is going to be covering it crazily. There's loads going on behind the scenes. Hopefully lots more content coming your way. And once again, thank you, Mike.
No problem. And I loved, listen, I've been loving all the content that's been coming out. Simon's interview with Dan Rhodes, just on kind of what preseason is all about, was fantastic. Your discussion last night with Chris Williams on Nabby was also interesting. It sounds like there's more to come. So, you know, it's a feast. It's a feast. And so thanks for serving it up.
No problem at all. This is, you know, working hard and getting content out during the off season. It's tough sometimes because it kind of feels like we're saying the same stuff, but hopefully next coming weeks is going to be, it's fun that there's games. We haven't even talked about the Wigan game. Great.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Mo Salah scored. We might as well just quickly cover it. Mo Salah scored and that's that.
Yeah, that's about it. You know what though? It was great. That was a classic example of viewing that one, where the Simon Brundish's, and Dan's podcast really educates you on what to look for, and just kind of how it works during preseason and where matches fit in and what they're trying to accomplish as a coaching staff. And so I probably would have looked at the game differently before hearing that podcast, but I saw things there that actually encouraged me about sort of where Sturridge looks like. He's put on some upper body weight, by the way. He's looking muscly.
It's good. He's been working out very, very hard throughout the summer. That's it now. We're definitely going. So thanks again to Mike. And we'll be back with another Gags Tandon show soon.
Network.